This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll revisit our conversation that we had recently with State Senator Eddie Melton and his colleague from Indianapolis, Greg Taylor. They're both members of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, and they will be talking about the Town Hall Meeting Series. The final one of these series is happening this weekend at IU Northwest in Gary. And we'll also have for as well another piece from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And we'll tell you more about an Indianapolis barber who has added the job of farmer to her resume and tell you why she has gotten that distinction in trying to help deal with the food deserts all around the state of Indiana. The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus holds its final town hall meeting in the series of meetings across the Hoosier State this coming Saturday in the Berglund Auditorium at the Savannah Center at Indiana University Northwest in Gary. We had both the State Senator Eddie Melton of Gary and his legislative colleague, State Senator Greg Taylor of Indianapolis, with us on Regionally Speaking earlier this month to talk about the Black Legislative Caucus and the town hall series of meetings. And here we have for you now that conversation. Tell us, for people who are not familiar with what the caucus is, how it got started, from what you know, and what the objectives are.
Well, we have about 14 members of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus from across the entire state that represent their various districts, both on the House and the Senate side. And individuals bring a very wide array of expertise from their personal background, from the legal perspective, health, education, and a variety of other areas. And the Black Caucus, we've been traveling across the state and just sharing and recapping last legislative session and just taking a lot of input and feedback from the public and on how to address significant issues in our communities and how to bring that up in the next General Assembly that's going to take place next year.
And one of your colleagues on the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus is State Senator Greg Taylor, who is from Indianapolis. In fact, he's on the line from the capital city. Senator Taylor, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, since Eddie had mentioned here about the diverse membership of the caucus, the diverse experience and expertise of the caucus, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you bring to the table, so to speak, as far as the Black Legislative Caucus is concerned.
Yes. Well, I've represented District 33, which is the west side of Indianapolis, since 2008, which is my first legislative session. And I am I'm a practicing attorney here in Indianapolis. So really a lot of the legal / analytical, logical reasoning things come through my desk. And I provide a lot of assistance to the members in regards to that area. And I also serve on two of the fiscal committees here in the legislature that have a significant impact on the type of funding that we give out to programs. So my job, along with Representative Melton, is to provide any expertise that I can from my professional experience. And then we have other people who handle, for example, healthcare issues, education issues, and things of that matter. So we have a very diverse group of individuals in regards to background and expertise. So if I had to pinpoint mine, it would be more from a legal standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, for folks that are not necessarily familiar with how the state is made up as far as the districts are concerned, we're familiar with what Senator Melton's district is like here in Northwest Indiana. Tell us about the district and the people you represent there on the west side of Indianapolis.
So my district starts at about 10th Street, which is the southern part of my district in downtown Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And if you could imagine with the urban interest becoming more popular, it's a diverse group of individuals from an ethnic standpoint that live in downtown Indianapolis. And then my west boundary is 465. Mm-hmm. They rode 465 around Indianapolis, and then the northern part of my district goes to 71st Street,
wow,
which encompasses a very diverse working class district in Pike Township, as well as a professional area down in northern center Township and southern Washington Township. And then I have some very impoverished areas over on the west side of Indianapolis that I represent that, you know, have a whole set of issues different than those of the people who I represent in the center part of my district. So it's very diverse from a socioeconomic standpoint, from an ethnic standpoint, and from a what I would call a public policy standpoint. There, you know, when I send out surveys, it's very interesting at the responses that I get, especially on those issues like gun control and things like that.
I would imagine then that just knowing your district as I do just in my mind's eye, probably Senator Melton drives through your district all the time when he comes down to the State House coming down on I-65 to come down to the legislative sessions.
Oh, yeah, everyone who drives in.
That's right. That's exactly right. You drive right through the area there, but as soon as you get down to until you get down to 10th Street and get a little further south, and you've already gone through Senator Taylor's district. You talked about the interest that you have, of course, of your constituents, concerns of your constituents here, and we know about Senator Melton's constituents here in Northwest Indiana. What kind of comments have you all heard in the earlier series of the town hall meetings that you've had as you get ready to come back up here into Gary this time?
Yeah, and I'll start and just kind of share some of the things I've heard specifically. We just had a recent town hall in South Bend, and I think the key thing that I took away from that conversation was around education and also around economic development. So, and I haven't attended every single town hall, but it's been a common theme for the ones I have participated in, especially in Indianapolis, and also from a healthcare perspective. And it's been a significant population of African-Americans that have attended these, but it's been a very diverse crowd as well.
You know, now, do you find that, now, since you mentioned you've only met a few of them here, I know that some of the ones, of course, have happened in Evansville, for example, in the south, as well as Fort Wayne to the north and east, and Lafayette, which is not all that far from here. Have you, all either of you gentlemen, come across the same basically common themes and that's been brought up by the residents when you've had the town hall meetings in those areas?
Oh, yeah. I think this is part of what we see from our constituency is that everyone is concerned about what is going to happen with the healthcare system here in the state of Indiana. I can say that is one of the same, that topic is similar for wherever we go. Mm-hmm. Now, I would be remiss if I would not defer to Senator Melton about his district, but I can tell you this, education is always one of those things that is discussed and that is brought up by the public. What are we going to do about public education? And, you know, Senator Melton has done an excellent job here in the short period of time that he's been here to garner the respect of a lot of people in regards to education and the concerns that you have up in Northwest Indiana. So education is definitely the top of the list. And then a very close second is economic development. What are we going to do to provide jobs where people can raise a family? You know, we talk about low unemployment rate here in Indiana, and that's something we should promote. But we don't talk about the living wage. And that is a concern of mine, and I think of the Black Legislative Caucus going forward. What are we going to say to those people when they come to us and say, hey, look, I've been working 40 to 50 hours a week, and I still can't make the basic payments for my children and rent and car and insurance and everything else that goes with it. What are we going to say to those people when they can barely live, but they're working? What's the next step? What are we supposed to do?
Now, what do you hope that will likely come about from all the discussions, the comments that you've heard from residents during the town hall meetings that you've attended as well as the ones you've held? What do you think that are likely to come up here in the 2018 General Assembly session, that knowing the information that you have with the wishes, the concerns of the residents?
You know, one of the things I'm hearing a lot more is about redistricting and the impact that has on voters and from an equity standpoint, making sure that their voices are heard. There's a lot of, if you sit back and you look at the way the maps are drawn right now, there's a lot of advantages to our friends across the aisle. And I think Senator Taylor, mm-hmm. he you could speak to that specifically with the bills that you've seen come across that impact the judges in elections in Marion County.
Yeah, and let me say this. I agree with Senator Melton. Redistricting is very important because this is what the let me give you an example. I serve a district that's 76% Democrat. So I'm one of the benefactors, if you will, of this gerrymandering that we call it. But remember that if gerrymandering benefits Democrats, then it benefits Republicans because you can't draw a Republican district without drawing a Democrat district. People tend to disregard that. As a Democrat, I am saying to you that that is not fair to my constituents. I shouldn't be able to choose my constituents. My constituents should be able to choose me. Now, I think I've done enough in my district to garner the support of both Republicans and Democrats because I think the bills that I put forth are not political. They are definitely to help the state of Indiana and the entire state. But if you could imagine, this is what happens when you have supermajority. This past session, there was a bill that Senator Melton just referred to that now has changed the way we elect our, well, just forget that. It took away the right of the people of Marion County to elect their judges. Now, we can talk about all the other stuff that goes with that, but the bottom line is this. If there was an election in Marion County, and it was a straightforward election, there is not one political pundit that would disagree with this statement. It would be 95% Democrat judges on the bench. Now, knowing that, the supermajority took it upon themselves to put us in the merit selection process. Now, there are some good things about merit selection in regards to selecting judges, but let me give you the short here, but we have a merit selection example that just happened this year, and that was replacing a Supreme Court justice. That was merit selection, and look what we got. We had a Democrat, African-American, serving on the Supreme Court. The replacement is someone who is Caucasian, who is a Caucasian male Republican, because it's merit selection. So now we have four Caucasian males and one Caucasian female on the bench of the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. That's merit selection. So, and they changed Marion County to that, and the bill only passed 28-22, which shows you, and we only have 9 members as Democrats.
Yeah.
So there had to be 13 Republicans vote with us. That was a very controversial bill, but that's a result of supermajorities, which is created by this by the way they're gerrymandering the district. Mm-hmm. So I hope people find it in themselves to go out and vote and support people and ask the question, do you support the way that we choose, that the legislature chooses its constituency, or would you rather have the reverse, where the constituency chooses their legislature?
Let's say Senator Greg Taylor, who's a Democrat from Indianapolis. With us in the studio is State Senator Eddie Melton, a Democrat from Gary, and both of the members of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus. The Black Legislative Caucus has been holding town hall meetings across the Hoosier State. The last of the series is going to be happening here very soon. In fact, coming up in just a matter of weeks or so on August 19th, it'll be at IU Northwest in Gary. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and with me in the studio is State Senator Eddie Melton, the Democrat from Gary, and on the phone with us from Indianapolis is State Senator Greg Taylor, both members of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, the last of the series of town hall meetings across the Hoosier State that the Black Legislative Caucus has been holding is coming up on August 19th. It'll be at the Berglund Auditorium, which, of course, is in the Savannah Center on the IU Northwest in Gary. And we've heard about some of the comments and concerns that members of the Black Legislative Caucus not only have on their own as legislative members, but also what they've heard from their constituents and just people that they visit around the state. And you've mentioned, Senator Melton, about the concerns that you heard in not very far away from here, from South Bend. And as you've all mentioned, that a lot of the issues are basically common across the Hoosier State, many of them dealing with education, some of them dealing with economic development, and in particular here, concerns about how the districts are, at the legislative level, are drawn up, and that, and of course, having impact on voters as well as the residents in these areas. Do you think that you're going to hear anything that might be a bit different when you have the session here in Gary?
You know, I'm expecting to hear some of the similar topics and conversation that was taking place. Some of the most interesting dialogue happens after the town halls, in my opinion, when individuals come to you one-on-one, mm-hmm. and want a little bit more in-depth conversation about particular subjects. And I'm expecting that's going to be the same thing in Lafayette and as well as in Gary.
We should mention, by the way, that if you happen to be on our southern edge of our listening district here, down in Benton County, near Benton County, down in Newton and Jasper counties, next meeting is coming up before the session in Gary is going to happen in Lafayette. It'll be on August 12th, and that's going to happen in the downtown branch of the Tippecanoe County Public Library, which is on South Street in downtown Lafayette. So if you are able to make that session, that's an opportunity. But, of course, the one in Gary is coming up here, as we've mentioned, on August 19th. Senator Taylor, when you have a chance to catch these other sessions, do you have a chance to talk with residents as well afterward?
Oh, yeah. That to me, is the most compelling thing, is that the residents get to talk to us one-on-one about some of the concerns in their district. You know, what really I find to be beneficial is that when we go to certain districts, we also let the representative and the senator who represents those areas know that we're going to be in town. And it's amazing to see them show up, even if from the other side of the aisle, and mm-hmm. listen to what their constituency is saying. You know, sometimes we fall into our thoughts and processes as legislators, and we think that everybody thinks the same. I think that some of the legislators, if they were to show up to some of these, they would hear things that they've never heard before from some of their constituents and really take a closer look at what they're doing here in the state of Indiana. I'm not one of those people that wants to, I think that when we go to someone else's district, we should let them know. We should let them know, their constituents know how they vote on issues, and see if those issues actually fit the constituency that they're representing. And, we respect the legislators and the districts, and that's what I find the most compelling part is after we get done doing our presentations, they come up to us and say, well, how did my legislator vote on this issue? And, then that sparks another conversation. Well, what should I do to let them know how I feel? And then the conversation goes on from there. So I find that to be the most critical part of the meeting is afterwards when people get to talk to us and ask us questions.
That's great. Senator Taylor, do you think you'll be able to make it? Maybe Gary's a little too far for you to make the trip from Indy, but are you thinking to make some of these other northern Indiana last ones here that left Lafayette, maybe perhaps Gary?
You know, Senator Melton might get mad at me if I didn't show up there. So, I went to the one in Evansville, which would be the longest drive. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to make the one in South Bend, but I plan on making it to the remainder of the session.
I hope you make them. I definitely want to give you a tour of some areas, too, when you get here.
I appreciate it.
That's great. That's State Senator Greg Taylor, who's a Democrat from Indianapolis, who, as we mentioned, is one of the members of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus. Senator Taylor, thank you very much for spending some time with us today here on Regionally Speaking to talk about what you get as the takeaway from these town hall meetings, and look forward to you making the stop up north here for this final one coming up here on August 19th.
Well, I appreciate you calling in, and I just want to tell all your constituents that Senator Melton is doing a great job up here. He's already gotten the respect. I've never seen, and he's going to get mad at me for saying this, but I've never seen the appropriations chair get emotional at the microphone until he talked about how he worked closely with Senator Melton on the Gary School situation. So you guys got a great senator from up there, and make sure you continue to support him.
Senator Taylor, by the way, was in his Indianapolis law office when we made that conversation. And Senator Eddie Melton was here with us here at the Lakeshore Public Radio studio when we talked back on August 2nd. Once again, the town hall meeting set up by the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus is this coming Saturday. It'll be held in the Berglund Auditorium at the Savannah Center at Indiana University Northwest in Gary. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I am originally from a small rural area in southeast Arkansas. I live on a farm. Growing up on a farm is very different from a lot of people's childhoods, I've learned, because most of my days as a young Arkansan were spent outside. Like, I didn't get to watch television, didn't have a computer, didn't have a phone, didn't have a game console. So, like, we would spend most of our days with my grandpa, and he would say, go outside, and we would go outside. Having grown up like this, yes, I would say definitely there are people that don't understand this difference between living in a fairly isolated place versus and then coming to a more populated place. Because it doesn't make sense to them to have to sit and contemplate what you've seen on the day, because you're used to having time to sit back and say, okay, I've seen this, what does it mean, what can I do with it, how do I feel about it? So it seems a little strange to them when I get, like, people overload, because they're like, what's wrong with you, why don't you want to talk to anyone? It's like, well, because I've talked to 5 other people today, I can't take anymore. There's definitely a, you're weird, why does this bother you kind of dynamic. There are many, many assumptions about rural communities. Most of them are kind of goofy stereotypes, like you don't have straight teeth and you still use outhouses, or like you're not intelligent because you've grown up with nothing but coyotes and rabbits for company. I don't want to be thought to be less intelligent than everybody else around me just because I didn't grow up with like 15 different friends and social events every day, because you can learn a lot about life just by being in the woods versus in a city. But a lot of people get kind of nervous about, like, oh, you're taking me into the woods, what are you going to do to me? So it's kind of hard to bridge that gap. The woods are actually a beautiful place. I mean, yeah, they're kind of scary in the dark if you don't know where you are, but if you just pay attention and go with somebody, you can learn a lot.
And you can hear this conversation and more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. More groups, from utilities to businesses and even schools, are investing in solar energy. Its popularity continues to go up while the costs go down. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports that that might not be the case for much longer because of a state law that was approved and signed into law earlier this year.
As you drive down the county road toward Lowell Middle School, you might be surprised by the solar panels that jump out from behind the cornfields.
The height doesn't restrict the rolling hills or the view of the cornfields or all the things you would expect in a rural community, all right? And at the same time, it looks like the future.
Tri-Creek School Corporation Superintendent Deb Howe says students doing a class project 3 years ago became outraged by the school's electric bill. They developed a plan to reduce costs. The solar array at Lowell Middle is the largest of 4 installations spread among Tri-Creek schools. Howe says the system cost about $3 million up front, a hefty fee. But the solar panels will save the district close to $250,000 a year.
We made that upfront investment, and then we will generate 4 times that amount that will continue to be in our general fund to aid in education.
It's more than schools investing in solar. The IKEA, soon to open in Fishers, will run on rooftop panels. And electric utilities are expanding their portfolios, partly, Hoosier Energy's Heath Norick says, because customers demand it.
They want solar, they're interested in solar, and their expectation is that we can do it more efficiently, and so they're looking for us to do that.
Hoosier Energy provides electricity to the state's rural electric co-ops. It's building 3 new solar arrays and wants renewables to account for 10% of its energy mix by 2025. And, Norick notes, demand isn't the only thing behind the expansion.
Cost, being very conscious with our dollars that our end consumers are paying.
Norick says the co-op makes decisions on a 25 to 30 year timescale, so he's not worried about rhetoric from the Trump administration on cutting support for renewables. And Sean Gallagher with the Solar Energy Industries Association says that's a common position among utilities.
There's a snowballing effect that has begun to occur. Customers like it. utility companies accept it, and the cost is competitive. So we'll see more.
But just because utilities like solar for themselves doesn't mean they like solar for everyone.
We've seen pushback against rooftop solar and against things like net metering in a number of states, including in Indiana earlier this year with the legislation that was passed.
Gallagher's talking about hotly contested reforms to the state's so-called net metering policy. Now, future solar customers will receive less money when they sell excess energy they produce back to the grid. The Indiana Energy Association, the lobbying group for the state's utilities, fiercely supported the bill. The group says solar customers got an unfair subsidy paid for by the utilities. But Deb Howe says there's no way Tri-Creek could afford its solar system under the new law. The district is grandfathered in, but Howe says she regrets more schools won't be able to take advantage of solar.
All the money that we use is taxpayers' money. If you don't have to spend as much money for the electrical output, it can go back into supporting students. But you know, people are ingenious. Given a set of problems, they will come up with a solution.
And a solution might end up presenting itself. A legislative committee is supposed to meet by the fall to study how school districts are affected by the bill. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
And in this nation's war on drugs, we generally hear about the raw numbers, the reported, the deaths, the scary statistics, the lack of options for many people. And in fact, also too, coming up is International Overdose Awareness Day. That'll be on August 31st. But we rarely hear about the people who have been able to help individuals who have been afflicted with the disease of addiction. And we have with us in the studio one of these people who works very hard. In fact, is because of his efforts, and not only in private practice, but also as a member of the team at the Recovery Works facility in Merrillville, has picked up a special honor from the Lake County Council. Back on August 8th, Lake County Council issued this proclamation. In honor of Dr. Brent Jacobus, the Lake County Council recognizes him for his meritorious service, his dedication, integrity, selflessness, humanitarianism, and in recognition of International Overdose Awareness Day on August 31st, honors him with his commitment for his commitment in its efforts to help prevent and treat some of those people with drug addictions. And Dr. Jacobus, thank you for being with us here and regionally speaking today.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, tell us and tell our audience as well, too, a little bit about yourself. We mentioned earlier that you're in private practice in addition to being the medical director for the Recovery Works facility in Merrillville. Tell us about what you do and most of the time that you spend away from the center.
Okay. Yes. I was raised out East Coast and eventually made my way out here, met my wife, and we have been living here for about 25 years and been in private practice that long also here. We do a wide variety of procedures in the office and different things like that. And my parents always raised me to the golden rule, so to speak, to give back. And I've always been attracted to those less fortunate. And we've done medical missions over the last 20 years where we've gone all over the world and set up medical clinics and really tried to promote health and understanding and wellness and really treat patients' physical needs. And when you deal with their physical needs, they're more open to hear, you know, emotionally, spiritually, what you can really help them in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of brought that back to the practice, and it seems like we kind of just, you know, over the years went to start treating more addiction-type patients, and I've really enjoyed that.
Was it during these medical missions that maybe you were exposed to more people that had problems with drug addictions of all kinds, or addictions of all kinds, actually, not just drugs, because the Recovery Work Center takes care of not only the opioid and the usual narcotics addictions, but also with alcoholism and other addictions as well. Is this where you finally, I guess, at first got exposed and probably in large numbers to people that have the problem?
Sure, sure. It's a epidemic all over the world, as you know, and it's getting worse in this country, and we see that. And I like the way everyone's really kind of gearing up now towards it. In the past, there has not been a whole lot of options. You know, we used opiates to wean patients off of opiates, and it was a difficult thing. And I think the making of Vivitrol, which is an opiate antagonist medication that we use, has really helped the addiction population tremendously. And in this area, there really hasn't been a place like Recovery Works where you can go inpatient and also outpatient. And I like the idea that they not only treat the physical addiction, the physical withdrawal symptoms, but they also work on the emotional, the behavioral, the cognitive type therapies, and that's why the results are really good.
You talk about using a medication to try to wean patients off the opioids and the other narcotics that they may be addicted to, and of course we've heard for decades, it seems like, about methadone being used to help wean people off narcotics and the like here. Are we finding these newer medicines that are coming out now that you have the opportunity to use in your practice and at the center are doing a better job as opposed to how methadone seemed to work?
Yes, absolutely. Methadone was good for a season. It had its place, but now with Suboxone and Vivitrol, that's really the way to go. It takes the withdrawal from the patient and also takes that craving away, which is the most important. And then it also cognitively helps them function better.
Mm-hmm. We hear so much lately about all the problems with the super strong, dangerously deadly strong opioids that are out there and how just one brief contact, a moment, Carrie, even just a smidgen of the medicine or the substance can get people hooked or even kill them. You run into situations like this at the center all the time?
Yes, we see that. You know, and fentanyl is probably what you're talking about.
Right, that's one of the worst ones we know. Yes. That it's out there. Because even law enforcement officials out there on the street dealing with picking up and arresting people for narcotics-related crimes find themselves exposed to this, and some people unfortunately get overdosed accidentally because of it.
Oh, yes. Some people who are using heroin think that it's plain heroin, but it's really not heroin. It's fentanyl. And fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin.
When you come into these cases there at the Recovery Works facility, let people know who may not be familiar with how the center works. If somebody comes in the door, so to speak, and hopefully these are people coming in on their own, they're not being brought in by ambulance or some other means after some incident happening, how are they dealt with there at the center?
Yeah, obviously the best way to come to the center is if, you know, a certain individual desires to get help. You know, if a patient gets to the point, a client gets to the point where they really want help, there's help now available where it really wasn't in the past. So when a patient comes in, they can be full-blown addicted. We can handle any kind of situation for the most part. We give them medications and, you know, it's a brand new facility. The rooms are very nice. We kind of bring them down from the withdrawal. And then after they're on that inpatient, then they'll switch over to a different side of the facility, and that's where they're getting the intense counseling several times a day. And, you know, the reports I hear back from patients who have been successful, and even outsiders, who even professionals who have issues and went through that, they really speak so highly of the counselors there at the facility. We have such a great team. And then after they get through that issue, then we work with them as outpatient, which solidifies their treatment and their recovery.
Do we find that that many people probably, I guess they take some while, I suppose, to go through the initial very, very difficult inpatient process of getting off the drugs at least and then get to that point where they can go to outpatient status and go to counseling and the like too? Are we finding that that you have, you know, more success stories this way when they go through this gradual process, maybe having to stay in facility for a while, and then they get to move their way to the next phase?
Yeah, that's really the best because patients can't deal with that. Clients can't deal with that as an outpatient when their physical body is aching. And from what I've been described in the past, it's almost like somebody taking a sledgehammer and hitting your bones, mm-hmm. every bone. And so it's so painful that people can't really deal with that. So inpatient, if we can comfortably deal with that, then as they move, they become successful because as their cognitive mind starts changing, they can start dealing with normal activities where they couldn't in the past. So it's a whole program, not just physical, but emotional, behavioral. You have to learn to think different. You can't think like an addict anymore.
We only hear about examples of people that have to go through withdrawal that are, in some cases, force themselves through a planned and a forced withdrawal to try to wean themselves off. And I know there's one in particular comes to mind from watching the PBS series Jazz. We hear about the stories about jazz musicians who become addicted to heroin and all that was, of course, the terrible trend that happened back in the 40s into the mm-hmm. 50s. And in particular with, of course, a very famous jazz trumpeter, Miles Davis, who became addicted while he was in jazz quartets and groups in New York City. And it finally got to a point where it basically pretty much disturbed his performance abilities. He said he took himself home to his family farm just outside St. Louis in Illinois, and he locked himself in his room in his parents' farmhouse, and he just fought it through. And he talked about the days and nights of screaming pains, you know, that completely racked his body. And all of a sudden, it was like daylight after a storm, that he just came out of the room and he was completely free of the disease. Not many people are brave enough to do that, I would suppose, and certainly not now with the intensity of the narcotics that are out there, are there?
Yeah, no. And, you know, and it goes back to when someone takes heroin or a strong opiate, what happens is it decreases the dopamine in the brain, and that's the neurotransmitter that gives us pleasure. Mm-hmm. So when it depletes that, the only way to get that pleasure back is to use more heroin or more opiates, and that's what keeps driving that addiction so much. You know, another thing about the recovery works that I like so much is it's a 12-step program, and that's the key. Is there are people like Miles Davis and different people that can do willpower, but majority of people, you know, we need a community. You know, we need a support group. We need the counseling through the 12 steps. You first realize you have a problem. The second step is the most important, and that's relationship with God, because He's the only one who's going to change your heart and your mind, because it has to be more than just physical willpower. You know, we need support. We need people around us to walk us through this difficult thing.
I guess you don't think as much as the necessity for being a religious person, or at least recognizing the importance of God in your life. But it is part of the process, I guess, of dealing with your problems, and in particular dealing with this terrible opioid that you're still running through your system.
Yeah, it really is.
When you get involved with organizations here in Northwest Indiana, as not only a physician in private practice, but also with your work with Recovery Works in Merivale, do you get to talk to people, not only tell your story, explain the problems and the issues that the center deals with all the times, but do you get support from the community and these organizations for what is happening?
Yeah, different communities will contact us to, you know, ask about what the process is and if they can refer people in. We get a lot of referrals. We're all also active in a Celebrate Recovery, which is local. Also, it's nationally, actually. Mm-hmm. But that's a faith-based. But that also goes through the 12 steps. So they kind of go hand in hand. But different people will ask questions and support as far as financially, I'm not sure.
What kind of programs that you're aware of? I know now Recovery Works, of course, is a national program that's based with the Pinnacle Treatment Centers nationwide. What kind of programs that you learn about from some of the other centers across the country that are being introduced into the facility in Merivale, and ones that are maybe out there that could possibly be introduced to help people that have the problems with addiction?
To be honest, I'm not sure of any new ones coming in. I'm sure there are. There are many treatment centers. I know Pinnacle has several, probably 32 some throughout the country, nationally recognized, and they sit on the board. But I don't know of any new ones.
I just didn't know if there were ones that are out there that maybe other centers are learning about, they're introducing, trying out at least on a trial basis, and are having success with them, that they are enabled to say to the other centers, well, this is available here. We'll teach you, give you all the information about these particular programs and help you learn how to integrate them into what you're doing now. I suppose you probably learn these things every day. It's like every doctor who goes through kind of an education process all the time anyway that you have in your profession, that you're able to kind of add these new skills in, this new information in, and help put them together to work.
Yes, and collaborative efforts are very important, and we do. I can't think of names offhand, but we do collaborate on different treatments and what's been working, and you know, ultimately we want to get the best model for the people in any area.
In closing, Dr. Jacobus, would you say that there's anything in particular or any things in particular that you take away from that your work with Recovery Works that help you in your medical profession besides what you're doing there at the center?
I think probably the biggest takeaway is when you see people's lives, they can be – anyone can be very close if they make a mistake, or – you know, we all make mistakes. We all do have struggles. But if you pick that one struggle, that one opiate or problem, you realize how it can devastate your life. But we never want – you know, the biggest detriment to an addict is they go through guilt and shame. And if we can get rid of that guilt and shame and realize that there's hope for them, then there's a plan that they can get better. And you just get so much more compassion when you see people just like yourself who are struggling. And they may be lawyers, maybe doctors. There's no, on this drug addiction epidemic, there's no socioeconomic difference.
We've been talking with Dr. Brent Jacobus, who is the medical director for the Recovery Works facility in Merivale, and he's also a physician in private practice here in Northwest Indiana. Dr. Jacobus, once again, congratulations for picking up the honor from the Lake County Council as it comes up here on recognition for the very special day of noting, International Overdose Awareness Day, which is going to be on August 31st. And thank you for coming by the studios to talk about yourself, about the Recovery Works program, and how it's helping people here in Northwest Indiana every day.
Thank you so much, Chris. My pleasure.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
The Calumet Collaborative, in its webpage, says it catalyzes innovative partnerships between Indiana and Illinois government, business, community, nonprofits to advance, a way to, in turn, make the Calumet region a better place to live and work. And it's focusing in primarily with sustainability and environments, as well as economic development. Interesting way to combine the two. And with us to talk about the organization and some of the latest efforts and latest conversations they've had, we have the acting executive director of the Calumet Collaborative, Sarah Coulter, with us. Sarah, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we get an idea of what the organization's all about. It's kind of a bi-state affair, not unlike in the initiative for the Wolf Lake, the Association for the Wolf Lake Initiative, where you've got, in this case here, a lake that straddles both sides of the state line. Where does the Calumet Collaborative fit into the picture for not only sustainability, but economic development here in our part of the state?
The Calumet Collaborative is working to help people understand that nature doesn't know jurisdictional boundaries, and that in the Calumet region, there are people that live, work, and play on both sides of the state line, many times crossing the state line on a daily or definitely weekly basis. So what we are hoping to do as an organization is not only recognize that, but by pooling resources from both states, we can rethink the future of the Calumet region through sustainable development, which means creating healthy communities, successful businesses, and thriving natural areas.
I suppose, too, it's important to note that folks on both sides of the state line obviously have to work together to try to work on these goals, to achieve the goals, but funding has something to do with it, too, so you have to work on both sides of the state line for funding for a lot of these ideas, don't you?
Yes, that's definitely sometimes a challenge, but not necessarily a big deterrent.
The website, by the way, goes into more detail, calumetcollaborative.org. You can find out more about the programs and the overall goals by going to that website. A lot of the conversations seem to come up here, and of course, because it involves the environment and some of our problems here in Northwest Indiana, involves what are called brownfields. For folks that are not familiar, first off, with what brownfields are, please explain it. And if you will, also tell us how the collaborative fits into trying to turn some of these rather tainted patches of land into some economic use, sir.
Yeah, the Brownfields Initiative is one of our four initiatives that we're leading for the near future. Brownfields, as we define it, we take the definition from the APA, but we define it as land that had previous residential, commercial, or industrial uses to it that are underutilized with the perceived or actual presence of pollutants, contaminants, or other hazardous materials. So taking these underutilized pieces of land and getting them back into productive reuse is one of the goals of the collaborative.
When you take on such a project like this, obviously you have to work amongst other agencies as well, so it's not something completely that the Calumet Collaborative can do. You have to work with local government, and here again this comes back to the basic mission of the organization, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And what we've found is that there's a lot of really good work happening around brownfields right now, but it's being done in silos. It's being done in individual organizations, and no one's really talking together. So in our brownfields working group, we have brought together organizations that are leading the way in Indiana, organizations that are leading the way in South Cook County, organizations that are leading the way in the south side of Chicago, and having them all at one table to discuss what is the best path forward. And one of the things that one of our first projects is to kind of get a map or an assessment of the current programs and projects that are actually going on right now, mm-hmm. and then mapping those potential opportunities for redevelopment in the entire Calumet region. So we know what we're working with, and we can prioritize which of these areas are best for redevelopment, which of these areas or these sites are best for conservation efforts, which of these areas might have flooding issues, and we could find a different use for them rather than focusing efforts on economic redevelopment specifically at that site. So really kind of getting a better idea of what we have in the entire region, what everyone's doing as, around the issue, and then being, you know, working together, because we find we can accomplish more together than we can in our separate organizations.
We're talking with the active executive director of the Calumet Collaborative, Sarah Colder, about the organization and what it does these days. One of the discussions, I understand, that came up at a recent meeting involved the development director for the Chicago-based Metropolitan Planning Commission. He came in and talked about, a firsthand account that he took, the latest of ones that he's done in the past, of revitalization efforts in the city of Gary. He made a visit there recently. Tell us, if you will, what he had to say, who he is, and what he had to say.
So I believe you're talking about Josh Ellis from the Metropolitan Planning Council, and they've been doing a number of different projects in Gary. But as most of your listeners will know, that Gary has a significant amount of challenges. But on the flip side, there's so many assets and opportunities in Gary. And I think that's true of the entire region, that there is so much more positive news than there is negative news.
That is Sarah Colder, who is the acting executive director of the Calumet Collaborative. You can go online to Calumet Collaborative at their Facebook page and find out more information about the agency. An Indianapolis barber added the job of farmer to her resume recently, and she's now working to improve access to fresh food in her northeast side Indianapolis neighborhood because it's a food desert like many places in the Hoosier State. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lita Noon gives us this profile of the woman who founded Lawrence Community Gardens.
Sharana Moore is taking her brother Otto to the grocery store.
Hey, brother.
Hey.
How you feeling?
I'm feeling all right, sis.
You was sick the other day. What was going on?
Oh.
My brother is on Social Security disability. He has Crohn's, and he also has schizophrenia.
Otto gets $180 a month in SNAP, food stamps. Moore says they stretch it as far as they can, and sometimes that's not enough. She asks if he wants her to go in with him.
Go in with you?
No, I'll be okay, shit. I love you.
I love you, too. Okay, I'll be out here.
Otto is one of many people in their neighborhood experiencing food insecurity, not having enough money or the ability to get to a grocery store. In food deserts like this one, people live more than a mile from a store that sells fresh fruits and vegetables. Moore says she sees kids getting food at gas stations before and after school.
They're getting that, and then they're going home, so they're not getting a quality meal on a day-to-day basis.
There are no traditional grocery stores, but fast food, gas stations, and liquor stores abound. Over a third of the people in the neighborhood live in poverty, and the Gallup HealthWays Well-Being Index shows Americans in poverty are more likely to suffer from chronic health problems. So late last year, Moore approached Monarch Beverage, a company in the neighborhood, and asked if she could use some of its vacant property to start a community garden.
Sharona comes in and she's very prepared.
This is Phil Terry, Monarch CEO.
And she's got data about the need for healthy food in this community and how, with cooperation from us and other members in the community, she could take some of this land that we're not using and turn it into something meaningful.
It all here. All those radishes y'all planted last week,
yeah,
they're starting to come up.
So residents can come for produce, and she's donating too.
My name is Molly Maddox. This is the Community Cupboard of Lawrence.
The cupboard provides food to 1,200 Lawrence Township families a month. She says the demand for fresh produce is high and points to donations she received from Moore's Community Garden.
So we got some tomato. I know there was tomatoes because everybody's been wanting tomatoes, and she was the first one to bring us those. And then lettuce, and I think cucumbers. I think she gave us some of the cucumbers.
The wet weather has been a challenge, but 2 acres of fruits and vegetables, including broccoli, collard greens, and watermelons, are growing. She says half the yield will be given away.
The rest of what we grow is going to be sold here on site at a farm stand so that we can have affordable access to farmers market style food for our communities.
They accept SNAP benefits, and they also have a free U-Pick section. Moore does not ask people to verify where they live and how much money they make, requirements in some food pantries.
I want to give people a more dignified food experience. No paperwork involved. We just want to know your name, and we weigh the food so that we can know how much we're giving out to the community.
Moore's goal in this inaugural year is to grow 20,000 pounds of food. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lee Dinoon.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking here today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We hope you'll join us tomorrow.